oh, I read your article and I thought it was just so well done and so well researched that I think it needs a much broader appeal to people just to understand where we're coming from with vaccines and also the history, because I think history is very important. And that's why I wanted to start with and ask you, what was it like for children 50 to 100 years ago before vaccines were available?
Well, you know, up until about 50 years ago, the only routine vaccination for most children was against smallpox. And that was, of course, a terrible disease, although by 50 years ago, it wasn't, the worst forms of it weren't very common. But you had the most frightening disease 50 years ago in the United States, and I assume in Canada as well, was polio. And, you know, almost every mother of that era who had a child was afraid. During the summer would come, which was polio season, and people were terrified that their children were going to get polio. And no one knew where it came from, really. There was really no way to prevent it because polio only occurs paralytic polio only occurs in about one of 200 children who get it. So many children would get it, and here one or two would pop up who were paralyzed by it. The rest would maybe have diarrhea, and that was it. That, of course, was an amazing conquest. The Salk, the vaccine created by Jonas Salk, that was first tested in 1954 and went on the market in 1955, almost overnight wiped out this disease that had been so terrifying to so many people. And that's, you know, widely recognized as the greatest conquest of vaccines, although polio still exists in a few corners of the world, and it's proved very difficult to eradicate it entirely. Another disease that was measles. Measles really, overall, was much more devastating than polio. Polio was more terrifying because it left its victims alive and crippled, and there for the most part, and there as reminders to all of us of, you know, the bad luck and the consequences of it. Measles, every child got, and about one in, you know, about 1,000 a year would be either killed or would brain damaged by measles in the United States every year. That was wiped out by vaccines beginning in the early 60s. Then there was rubella, another disease that was devastating, not because the disease itself was so serious in most people, but pregnant women who got rubella passed it along to their fetuses if they got it in a certain phase of pregnancy, and this could be devastating. In fact, rubella is one of the only known environmental, that is to say non-genetic, causes of autism. Children born in the first trimester of a woman who became ill with rubella, there were many, many cases of autism in these children, as well as deafness and other problems, mental illness, I mean, mental retardation. And then there's, you know, hepatitis B is a disease that vaccines are slowly whittling away at, and there are others, but I guess those might be the highlights.
Now, you mentioned the autism issue with regards to rubella, and that sort of links into now the lawsuits, I think, that may be starting up in the United States regarding thimerosal. And you provided an in-depth report on the subject, looking at the actual research. And I wanted to just start off so people understand what thimerosal actually is and how it differs from other mercury-containing compounds. Because when people hear the word mercury, there are the accidents in Japan, I believe, where they had mercury dumped into local water supplies and the damage to nervous systems in children. So what is the difference between this particular compound and other mercury-laden compounds?
Well, I believe that the famous case that you're talking about at Minamata, Japan, was methyl mercury, I believe. And in a way, thimerosal and methyl mercury are related. They're similar chemically, though not identical. the difference, I mean, I'm not a chemist or a toxicologist, but from what I've gathered is that thimerosal, you know, was not very well studied. And there was some concern initially when we discovered that children were getting potentially dangerous amounts of it, although, again, the emphasis has to be on potentially, because once the science was done to look at these children who'd gotten it and compare them to children who didn't, it was clear, it's pretty clear that it didn't really harm, or at least it didn't cause autism. Now, mercury is a damaging substance, and the difference, one thing to keep in mind is that thimerosal was used as a preservative in some vaccines, and it was very important to have a preservative in many of these vaccines because they were in large dose vials or even some that were in single dose vials. It's very easy for bacteria to contaminate these vials of vaccine. You need some kind of preservative there. Thimerosal, over time, had proven to be the best preservative for vaccines. And very small amounts of it were being used, in the millionths of a gram, between 12 and 25, I believe, micrograms, which is a millionth of a gram in each vaccine. So often people who talk about mercury damage will refer to an episode in the mid-century or early 20th century. Over a period of time, children got a disease. Children who were given teething powders got a disease called pink disease. And it had neurological symptoms, not totally dissimilar from autism, although not autism. But these children were given up to a gram of mercury over several months in these teething powders. Thimerosal, we're talking, you know, over the same period of time, children wouldn't have gotten anything near that. And the dose is the poison, they say. That's a kind of a common truism of toxicology. It is not to say that it was impossible that thimerosal could have harmed some children, but there isn't any evidence that it did, and there's been a lot of hysteria created around it.
We're in conversation with Arthur Allen. He's a freelance writer and science and health contributor to Slate.com and is currently writing a history of vaccination. And just before the break, we were talking about thimerosal, mercury, and autism. And in your article, you talked about the evidence looking at this specific issue and the studies, the good studies that were done. Can you sort of review what those were all about?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there were studies that compared children who'd received varying amounts of thimerosal through vaccination and those who'd gotten, well, comparing them at different levels. And in the clearest study was one from Denmark, probably because, and the most convincing to me anyway, because in Denmark they took all thimerosal out of vaccines in 1992, and the rate of autism went up there. They didn't get quite as much thimerosal in Denmark as our children did in America anyway. I'm not sure about, in the United States that is, Canada, I'm not sure, do you get a hepatitis B and a Hib shot, your infants?
Infants will get hepatitis B vaccine, but from my understanding in Canada, thimerosal has been removed from everything other than the flu vaccine.
I mean, the key thing for also, when since your show is aimed at parents, or at people as patients, you know, thimerosal, there's a little bit of it left in like a flu shots. It's at levels below anything it's been at in the last 60 years. There's certainly no reason to fear it anymore if there ever was in the past. But it's gone. In other words, essentially, substantially, there is no thimerosal in vaccines in the United States and I guess in Canada also. But so this study from Denmark was convincing. There was a study from Britain that showed about the same thing. There was a U.S. study that was very controversial because the initial results seemed to show some increase in speech delays and tics in children who had had large amounts of or relatively larger amounts of thimerosal at earlier ages. But after looking at these results more carefully and adding in children who were older, it didn't pan out. And you know, usually when you do a study, you're likely to find one or more results when you're looking at a variety of different endpoints, like, you know, speech delays, autism, tics, various things that were the variables in these studies. It wouldn't be surprising to find one or more of them seeming to have a positive result. And I think a few of these studies have showed an increase in tics among children who got relatively more thimerosal. But in other cases, they've showed, more, I think there were speech delays in children who hadn't gotten any thimerosal. So when you look at it on balance, it certainly shows no autism. It doesn't show autism being an effect of these vaccines. And whether there were some tiny effects in some children, you know, well, it's awfully hard to rule out absolutely something, you know, some kind of neurological effect. But overall, it doesn't seem there was anything there. And these studies are large and pretty convincing.
Now, also staying on the autism topic for just a short while longer,
yeah.
There is still the concern by some groups and advocacy groups of the link between the mumps, measles, rubella vaccine right. and autism, and they tend to cite a study done in the United Kingdom a while back. But my understanding of that is that The Lancet, which originally published that study, retracted it because of some methodological flaws in the study.
Well, yeah. I mean, the guy who brought the study forward didn't disclose to the editors of The Lancet that he had been paid to examine the children by a legal defense fund in Britain, which has been created for parents who were suing the government over alleged vaccine damage. So in other words, these parents were convinced that their children's problems arose from MMR vaccine. And he examined these children, and he did find that they had these gastrointestinal problems, and their parents said they had gotten the measles, the MMR shot, and that was why. But there was no science. There was never any science that supported that. I mean, it's the thinnest thing. I mean, you know, I'm sure this fellow, Andrew Wakefield, believes it. I mean, I just think I've looked at this. I've heard the guy speak. I just don't see anything there at all. And these children, I think for me, part of the problem, part of the sort of inability of the two sides to communicate on this issue, when I say two sides, I mean sort of established medicine and some of these parents of autistics, well, there are several issues. These children are very sick, and there's not that much that mainstream medicine or really anybody can do for them at the moment. And so they're very frustrated and angry, and they're looking for someone to blame. And then, you know, some of these children have a lot of illness that isn't explainable exactly by a genetic effect only affecting the brain. Some of them have immune function, strange immune readings, strange GI readings. And so they're looking for ways to deal with that. And that's all I think they have every right to. But somehow these problems, which may be related to autism, have been, this whole group of angry parents are convinced that it's related to vaccines, and there's just no evidence of that. There is evidence that they have unusual problems that maybe require some treatments that mainstream medicine has not been able to come up with. But to go from that to linking it to vaccines, I think, is a false step.
Why do you believe, or why do you think that anti-vaccine advocacy continues to grow? There, at least it seems to me that there's always, despite evidence, despite your research into this and the publication that you had, that there always will be a group that says, no, this data is flawed, or no, we don't believe this, and people will believe what they are saying. What has caused this lack of trust?
Well, I mean, I think that there are a lot of reasons for mistrusting the government. I don't trust my government entirely. So put yourself in the position of someone who has decided that this problem that they have was caused by the government. I mean, I think there's a generic mistrust, and it unfortunately has extended to doctors who and to authorities in general who really are authorities and are only out there trying to, you know, protect us all, but somehow because they're authorities, they get lumped in with some of the other authorities you can't necessarily trust for everything. And I also think, and that's part of the reason why I wanted to write this book, is that vaccines have a very particular way that they disturb people. Vaccines are given to healthy children. Other drugs, some of which have side effects, a variety of side effects, are given to treat a problem. People who have cancer take the most horrific drugs, because they're willing to put up with the side effects because that's the only hope they have of curing or at least putting off, you know, the cancer. With a vaccine, you're being injected, you're injecting it into a healthy child. So any perception that something went wrong with that vaccine is just intolerable to people. And unfortunately, it's very hard for an individual who perceives that as having happened to see the larger picture and say, well, look, you know, if 1 in 300,000 children who gets a polio vaccine gets polio, well, isn't that worth it to eliminate polio? I mean, of course, if it happens to you, you may not feel that way. But that's one side of it, which is that there are legitimately some side effects from vaccines, just as there are with all drugs. The other thing, harder to pin down, I would say.
Mr. Allen, I'd like to thank you very much for taking this time to speak to us. I'd love to have you back on the show again because I had many more questions for you.
I know. I probably went on too much but thank you so much for... I mean, I'd love to talk to you more about it.
Well, I'm guaranteed going to have you back on the show to discuss this some more.